Hi everyone, welcome to this week's episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, where we were joined by the brilliant Maddie Moat. Now, if you have children of a certain age, then you will know exactly who Maddie is. She is often seen on the BBC doing various kids shows, especially ones related to science communication. But if you want to know more about her, having heard her today on this show, and I'm absolutely certain you will, then the best thing to do is to go to her YouTube channel. So Maddie's YouTube channel is all about curiosity. It's all about animals, it's about plants, it's about travel, it's about technology. She is really right up our street. She loves everything about knowledge and her videos are absolutely fantastic. And if you want to find them, then go to youtube.com/Maddie Moat. That's M-A-D-D-I-E-M-O-A-T-E. Or just search for Maddie's name on the internet. If you'd like to learn more about us and what we're up to at the moment and in the future, then the best place probably at the moment is to go to Patreon. So if you go to patreon.com/nosuchthingasafish, you can sign up there. You don't have to pay anything. If you sign up, it is a place to get little free bits of pieces here and there and learn about what's going on. And then, of course, on top of that, we do have our various tiers if you want to support the podcast financially. And in return for doing so, you will get all sorts of amazing things, from ad-free episodes on our lowest tier all the way up to live internet quizzes and merch at our very top tier. Anyway, there's loads to see there, so just go to patreon.com/nosuchthingasafish to find out more. But in the meantime, really hope you enjoy this show with the fantastic Maddie Moat. On with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Dan Schreiber. I'm sitting here with Andrew Hunter-Murray, James Harkin, and Maddie Moat. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is Maddie.
Okay, so I thought I could pose this fact as a question, sort of a bit of a guessing game. Oh. So the fact is, in 1988, one particular company had to recall 30 million flutes. That is obviously an it's a lot of instruments.
Yeah.
So the question is, who is this company? Flute makers.
Obviously.
Yeah. Flute makers.
And they didn't put all the holes in.
They didn't, okay.
Oh, good call. It's a holeless flute. It's just a stick, really, that they sent out.
I was thinking too many holes.
Too many holes in a flute?
Definitely. Yeah.
Can you?
Absolutely.
I think so. I think it becomes a different instrument.
It's only a better flute up to a point. I think so. Okay. I
mean, you need hands over the holes, don't you?
Yeah.
You'd run out of fingers.
Oh, but if you had a spare set of hands, like a pantomime flute, you know, there's someone running the lower bit of the flute.
A double flute. Is that not flutes that go in both directions?
Like Darth Maul's lightsaber. I feel we've stepped away from this question.
Well, to help you out, these flutes were actually branded cool flutes. So I don't know if that has anything to do with kids. For younger people. And actually, it wasn't just flutes that were recalled, but also binoculars that were little cardboard boxes with plastic lenses. They were recalled at the same time.
Okay. McDonald's. Okay.
Yeah, I think you're on the right track.
Okay. Burger King.
You used to get toys and cereal.
Absolutely. So there you go. Bingo. So these cool flutes, they were actually found in boxes of corn pops and they were recalled by Kellogg's cereal. So it turns out these cool flutes, they were made up of two little tubes that sort of went into a mouthpiece and these tubes, they could fall out and they were a choking hazard. Oh, so they had to recall 30.
You know what they could have done with those flutes? More holes.
So the reason I was looking at this in the first place is because I've been, I guess, fairly interested in just this whole world of collectible toys recently, because it feels like we're getting a bit of a resurgence. Mm. The idea of blind boxes, toy collectibles is coming back.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, what was my equivalent when I was younger? And that for me was cereal box toys. But then I sort of started looking at the history of cereal box toys, and the toys were kind of fascinating. Mm. Like, do you remember ever? Do you remember any particular toys?
I think maybe my earliest ever memory is getting some Ghostbusters stickers from out of the cereal.
Yeah.
When the film came out.
Wow.
So that was like early 80s, right?
Yeah.
I don't think I was allowed to get the kind of cereals which came with toys in them.
Oh, no, they didn't have them in Old Brand, did they?
Yeah.
They just give you a little leaflet about your mortgage. And that's the fun for you to read.
You're stuck with like Weetabix. Yeah. Yeah. What about you, Dan? Do you remember getting any?
I remember the whole enjoyment and excitement of getting them. And right now I'm drawing a blank on the exact toys. But I do remember, like, quite often they were within the pack itself. You had to open up the plastic and you had to go through the Fruit Loops. And a lot of families had a policy that you had to wait till it fell out during a pour, as opposed to just getting right in and grabbing it.
Totally. It was whoever poured it into their bowl. That was the unwritten rule in our
house. Andy, you're an only child, aren't you? So you wouldn't have had this issue. But obviously, if you've got 3 or 4 kids... and you've only got one toy in a pack.
Yeah.
Right.
It becomes a big deal.
Yeah, but I think that's fair enough, the pouring out thing. Like, you're not allowed to plunge your hand into the Christmas pudding to pull out the sixpence, are you?
That's not allowed. Again, more insights into Andy's childhood.
Yeah.
Like, one really interesting thing is the people who made them had to make them a certain weight. And that is because of something called the Brazil nut effect. That if you get lots of things that are different sizes and different weights and you jiggle them around, eventually the bigger things will end up at the top and the smaller things will end up at the bottom.
Okay.
And this is something that's, you see this in all sorts of places, even like in avalanches, like the big bits of snow will be at the top and the small bits at the bottom. But they had this specific size and weight of these toys so that they knew that if they were jiggled around in transport, the toy would always be kind of in the middle.
That is incredible.
I didn't know that.
Yes. What was yours? You haven't given us yours.
Well, so I remember a colour-changing spoon that I got in Coco Pops.
Your favourite?
Yeah, so when it would go into the cold milk, it would change colour.
Oh, my God.
But actually, looking at the various toys there have been over the years, it very much started out as China cereal bowls that you would have to send off by collecting tokens on the back of boxes. Then Kellogg's sort of saw that they were doing this with Quaker Oats, and Kellogg's were like, we can get on the back of this. So they started making these farmyard storybooks with various flaps that you could make funny animals out of. And then that sort of like started the spiral of, okay, well, what else? What toys can we put inside the packets? And actually, this was sort of, I guess it became extremely popular after the Second World War. So we're sort of looking at the atomic age. So a lot of early cereal box toys are
radioactive?
Quite, literally, yes.
No.
No.
What?
Yes. Oh my God. So genuinely.
Oh my God.
But genuinely radioactive toys were placed inside cereal boxes.
Well, then you know where it is in the packet because you can see the glow.
When I was a kid, there was adverts. If you went Ready Breck, you would always have a glow around your whole body. I didn't realise it was a radioactive glow.
I remember if you had too much Sunny Delight, you sort of glowed orange.
That's
but
true.
That was a completely
We're all
thing.
Showing our age here.
Yeah, totally. But this toy, it was called the Lone Ranger Atomic Bomb Ring, genuinely.
Oh,
and you would get this inside Kix cereal, which you could get for 15 cents. This is in the US.
Wow.
It was a gold adjustable ring. There was a little removable cap. At the back, a little red cap that you could take off, and that's where you could hide secret messages.
Okay.
But then it contained something called, now I think I'm saying this right, but a spintharoscope. I don't know if anyone's heard of that before.
No.
It's basically a little device that would contain a small amount of radioactive material. So in this case, it's something called polonium-210.
I've heard of polonium.
There we go, polonium.
Normally, like, polonium's been deployed on the streets of London, not... free polonium in your... What?
So this was, you know, radioactive material discovered by Marie Curie. Tiny, small amounts of it were placed inside this ring. And then you would look into the atomic bomb through a little sort of lens that contained zinc sulfide.
Right.
And as the polonium was decaying, obviously you've got alpha particles that are shedding. They're hitting the zinc sulfide screen, creating little flashes. So the idea is your child could look inside the ring and actually see the scintillations of this radioactive material.
Yet it's the flute we record.
Exactly. And because it had choking pieces, yet this ring could be sort of taken apart with small caps and things, and apparently that's fine.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah.
I read this about this on Snopes, the website, and they said that there wasn't enough in it to do you any harm.
Right.
Sure.
Can I tell you guys my favourite cereal promotion ever?
Please do.
Oh, yeah, we all have one.
It's done by Quaker Oats.
Okay.
Yeah. It's 1954. Mm-hmm. They bought 19 acres of land in Yukon, in the Yukon territory, Gold Rush country in Canada.
Ooh.
And they divided up these 19 acres into 21 million square inches.
Right.
And they printed 21 million property deeds, each one for one square inch. And if you sent in a box top, you would be sent a square inch of the Yukon.
Wow.
What?
Yeah, how interesting.
When was this, Sandy?
1954.
Okay.
It was not legally binding.
Oh, really?
I was like, what does that mean? Could you go along and like dig in that tiny little patch?
It's gold.
With like a tea with your teaspoon. Yeah. But you got in a cereal box.
Yeah.
One boy who got one sent in four toothpicks and some string, and he said, "Can you fence my inch off, please?"
That's amazing.
That's really so sweet. People do collect these toys still, don't they? I went onto eBay to see what kind of things I could buy from cereal packets.
Yeah, I did too.
Okay, what have we found? Maddie, what have you found?
Well, actually, it was the ring, the atomic bomb ring. Yeah. I found with the box was going for $645.
The box makes a difference, doesn't it?
Huge difference.
And it's not like, you know, if you buy like a Marvel superhero figurine or something, it has to be inside the box.
Right.
Yeah.
You just have the box next to it flattened with the toy next to it.
Oh, is that still
so it doesn't have to be inside the box or anything.
Oh, God.
Okay. I found one which was some Coors Monsters from Frankenberry cereal in America, and they were £1,700.
Wow. Yeah. I didn't see anything that
feels like a lot.
Frankenberry.
Do you know Frankenberry? Have you come across them? Was it the 90s, I think, in America they had them, and they were a bit like, what are those cereals that have little marshmallows in? That have like got leprechauns,
Lucky Charms.
Yeah, yeah. So it was like that, but it was monsters. And the marshmallows were like pink and purple and stuff. And the kids were eating it. And this dye would go straight through them and come out of the toilet. And it looked like, you know, I've had this when my daughter eats beetroot. And I'm like to my wife, Belina, we need to go to A&E.
Yeah, yeah.
No, she had beetroot yesterday. But like it would come out. And they had a thing called Frankenberry stool. That was in like medical papers
saying that
this is
right.
It looked like people had had blood in their poo.
Was this one of the cereals that was basically 95% sugar?
Yes.
With some like,
I don't want to say because I think they might still be extant, but I think there was a lot of sugar in them.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about that is, so cereals, Kellogg's, like the Kellogg's brothers, they had a sanatorium in north of America somewhere. Battle Creek, that's it. And there were two brothers, and one of the brothers decided we're going to start putting sugar in it in order to attract younger people to eat it and not just be a health food. And they really fell out over that. And they properly fell out.
Wow, but ultimately, it was the fact that these were sugary cereals, which is why we stopped getting cereal box toys. There were many factors, but one of them was the fact that these were slightly less nutritious foods. Mm. I think there was a pledge. It was a voluntary pledge, which included the likes of General Mills and Kellogg's. They got together and they said, hey, you know what? It's not right for us to push less nutritious foods at children, which is why they started taking toys away. Although at first they removed toys for children, but that's when they started putting in things like pedometers and reflective bike stickers. So they didn't quite, they didn't sort of remove
Andy's
them.
Tell me more.
But yeah, so that was kind of their attempt to be like, okay, we're not putting toys in them, but we can put sports related gifts in.
Can I tell you guys something about a friend of the podcast?
Yes.
Yeah.
So Henry Perkey. You guys might remember?
Yeah.
Inventor of shredded wheat.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And father of the man who then invented round shredded wheat.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very much a Nepo cereal, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
I thought it was knitted by grannies. Can't believe this.
Myth busted. But his initial intention was not making shredded wheats to sell them to people. He wanted everyone to buy shredded wheat making machines. This was his big thing.
Okay.
He created a machine which shredded wheat. Mm. And then people just said, can we have some more of the shredded wheat, please? And he said, don't you want the machine that makes it? So there could have been a world where we all had on our counter.
Like a soda stream.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or an air fryer. Yeah.
I have a slightly random question for you, Maddie.
Sure.
So when I first moved to Australia when I was 12,
I
became starstruck when I met the voice of the Australian Coco Pop Monkey.
I know the British one.
Wow, this is what I was going to ask. You must know all of these people because of what you do. The world of voices for these iconic characters.
This is so bizarre that you've asked me this because genuinely one of my best friends is the voice of the Coco Pops monkey in the UK.
Wow.
No, I'm not even kidding.
Oh my gosh.
Genuinely, yeah.
Clang.
Yeah, he does really well from it. But, you know, the Coco Pops monkey doesn't talk so much anymore. So as far as I'm aware, you know, every couple of years they'll say, hey, can you come to the recording booth? And he'll just have to record a giggle.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think I would recognise his voice
no,
anymore.
Tony the Tiger is the one I
would recognise. If he was in the room next door, if I was in a restaurant and Tony the Tiger was at the next table.
You'd ask to be moved.
No, I would recognise it was him. Do you know what I mean? Yeah,
but this guy, he thinks everything's great.
Yeah.
My soup is not great.
But yeah.
Isn't yeah, as far as I know, that in his many years of being the voice of the Coco Pops monkey, Coco, I don't think the monkey talks much. Chocolatey goodness, something about turn to the milk, chocolatey.
Oh,
was that it?
Yeah.
I think that was kind of the catchphrase. Right.
That was a song when they briefly and ill-fatedly changed their name to Choco Crispies and then realised too late it didn't scan when they said, I'd rather have a bowl of Choco Crispies. Change it back.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that after years of publicly arguing that the Milky Way is the only galaxy in the universe, one of Harvard University's head astronomers realized that actually he was wrong and then went on to map 76,000 galaxies.
So wow. Awkward. Yeah. Who was he?
His name was Harlow Shapley. He lived 1885 to 1972, American astronomer, and he served as the head of the Harvard College Observatory. Now, what's amazing is up until the 1920s, most astronomers believed that our galaxy was the single galaxy in the universe. Mm. And that was it. If we were expanding, it would have been into that. You know, that was the idea of the time. So suddenly a few scientists started coming up saying, actually, I think it might be a bit bigger. One of whom was Edwin Hubble. And Shapley really thought that this was junk science. He took part in a debate with a man called Curtis, where they both presented their findings to say whether or not it was the case, and he stuck with it. And so it wasn't until Hubble eventually showed him proof by sending him a letter of something that he discovered that he then said, this has completely destroyed my universe, and accepted it, which is the wonderful thing about science. It's not opinion. If the facts are in front of you, you can go on to map 76,000 galaxies. It's quite
that
nice.
That is such a good quote as well. This is the letter that destroyed my universe, quite literally and in many, many ways. I love that.
Yeah. It's really cool. This debate they had is known as the Great Debate between Shapley and Curtis. And basically, Curtis thought that there was extra galaxies and Shapley thought that there was only one galaxy, but that we weren't in the middle of it. We were kind of on the side of it. And Curtis thought that we were in the middle of our galaxy. And it turned out they were both wrong, but both right at the same time, which again is quite good about science. It's like, you might be right, you might be wrong, or more likely, you might be kind of right in some ways and wrong in some ways.
Because we're not in the middle of our galaxy, we're on an arm, right? We're on an outer tentacle.
Exactly. We are.
Of the giant great octopus.
Thank you.
The center of our galaxy is within the Sagittarius constellation. And actually, it's the part of the Sagittarius constellation, I think it's the five brightest stars, that make up the shape of a teapot. So the center of our galaxy, the Milky Way, is sort of just above the spout of a teapot.
I know.
It's like a teapot.
Giant British flag at the center of the galaxy.
It's very British. Yeah. So it was Edwin Hubble that basically proved Shapley that he was wrong. But this isn't the first time that Edwin Hubble has proved somebody wrong.
Oh, really?
In fact, he also proved Einstein wrong at one point as well. Back then, Albert Einstein was looking at his calculations of space and going, this doesn't really quite make sense, because if gravity is such a big, important thing, then surely everything should be coming towards each other. Surely the galaxy should be shrinking. So to make sense of the maths, he introduced this thing called a cosmological constant, which is just, from now on, space is static. I say it still because that's what makes sense.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And then Hubble came along and was like, oh, really sorry, but actually, look at this. Here's my proof. We now know about looking at the way light moves and looking at redshift. I can tell you that the universe is, in fact, expanding. So I'm sorry, you're wrong. Wow. And Einstein said, yeah, that was probably my greatest blunder.
God, wow. Hubble knocks him down, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Hubble didn't have a funeral. His wife wouldn't tell anyone what had happened to him. Oh. I just find this mysterious.
But we know how he died, right? Like, it wasn't a mysterious death. And
I
she was
don't,
just like,
but I know that he died.
I think probably he died normally. And then She just didn't tell us the location.
What Dan's saying is we're not saying there's anything nefarious going on with his wife.
Yeah, I'm not saying there isn't, though.
Are you?
I'm just reopening this cold case.
I'm saying we don't know. And that's actually the scientific method, to just say we don't know and then hope someone else does the work. He didn't have a funeral, and his wife refused to say either where he was buried or whether his ashes had been scattered or where or anything like that. It was just an intensely private thing.
He was making lots of enemies of scientists by proving them wrong every day.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
Exactly.
There's nowhere to visit, but I guess he does have a fairly big telescope. Well, you know, observatory up there now that we can all remember him by.
That's true. Yeah. Yes,
he,
you're right.
He didn't start out as a scientist. He started out, thanks to family pressure, studying law.
Oh, yeah.
Because his family told him, look, there's no future in this science thing. And then he spent a year teaching high school physics, which I love. Imagine if Mr. Hubble was your physics teacher. It's pretty cool. And basketball as well. He was very nifty on the basketball court.
Not just nifty. He was a major basketball player for his college. And a lot of people said he could have become a professional in a couple of different sports. So he had that little decision to make.
One of those guys. Good at everything.
Shapley also had an interesting beginning, because he was an incredibly clever kid. He advanced in his school years. You know, those kids that you hear that graduate, you know, their high school when they're like nine. He was that kind of kid. And he didn't know what he wanted to study. And he decided, I'm going to just study and do in life what I see first on the list, the alphabetical list of subjects for college.
So he became an acrobat.
but only because aardvark studies was full.
He said he rejected archaeology because he couldn't pronounce it properly. So he picked astronomy. It's probably a nice mythology he's created for himself. But that's his claim.
In the 40s, he rescued lots of his colleagues from the Nazis. So lots of scientists in Germany, especially Jewish ones, were being victimized. And he got them out of there and brought them over to America and sort of said, oh, they're going to be really important for our university. So I'm going to get them out here. And they reckon he saved at least 1,000 families from the Nazis.
Wow.
That was Shapley.
That's and amazing. He said that the stars will not be of much good to us if we do not preserve the minds with which to comprehend them.
Ooh.
And then after that, he was accused of being a communist. And that's because in those days, you could be accused of being a premature anti-fascist.
Mm.
You were allowed to not
this
like...
This never happens, I swear.
So the idea is, like, if you didn't like the fascists in 1945, that was fine. But if you didn't like them in the 30s, that was dodgy in America.
Because they were still, the idea was that Hitler was the one who saved Germany from communism.
Generally speaking, in America, people were not massively anti the Nazis until the war.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And so if you could be seen to be anti them before the war, people thought you were a communist.
Oh.
Gosh.
Isn't that amazing?
So you had a narrow window to say, you know what? I'm not sure about these guys.
The more I hear about these. But he appeared before the Un-American Activities Committee, the McCarthy Committee.
Gosh.
Really interesting guy.
Yeah. That's fascinating. So the star that was spotted by Hubble is arguably the second most important star in the universe.
So is this the one that proved that we were right?
Yeah, it's called V1. And it's located in the Andromeda Nebula. It's 2.2 million light years away, and it has 1/100th of the brightness of the faintest star that is visible to our naked eye.
Mm. Right.
And I've read that it's often used as a marker for when you're judging other galaxies now, because you need a marker point to go where is further and where is not. And
so because it's a little bit dimmer, they can go, that is definitely really far away. Yeah. Way, way further away than anything that could be within our galaxy.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Which is pretty amazing.
Mm. Kind of just about see the Andromeda galaxy with a naked eye. If you really, really, really look, it just looks like a smudge if it's really dark.
Right.
They thought it was a star for a long time. And then it was only, of course, when they got these really good telescopes, you could tell that it was a group of stars.
That's quite a close galaxy, I presume.
Closest, I think, is it?
Not sure.
Maybe. It's one of our closest. I think one day the Andromeda is going to crash into ours.
Uh-oh.
You don't need to worry about it, because it'll be like in millions and millions and millions of years.
Yeah, but I've also read that if two galaxies are going to crash into each other, the size of galaxies would mean that you would just pass through each other and not notice.
What?
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, the space in between... each place in a galaxy is so great.
It's possible.
Surely there'd be some collisions with all just the stuff
What's
floating
more likely,
about.
I think, is that the gravity would pull them kind of together and they would join the mass of the stars.
Yeah, right. There'll be some dents in the fender, I'm sure, at the end of the process.
Yes.
50 billion of the stars in our galaxy now. They arrived here 8 billion years ago when our galaxy collided with another galaxy called the Sausage Galaxy.
Amazing. Amazing.
I don't even know whether to believe you.
It's true. It's true. It's sometimes, some spoil spots sometimes call it the Gaia Enceladus Galaxy. But definitely in some places called the Sausage Galaxy, and it collided with ours, and we got a lot of stars from
sausage
it.
And teapot is basically what we're talking about.
It's an English breakfast. Is this one giant full English that we're living in?
But on the sausage front, I do think some astronauts have reported just generally space to smell a little bit like barbecue.
Oh, and barbecue, really?
Yeah, because when they've come back in after a spacewalk, they've noticed the scent of barbecue on their spacesuits.
Wow.
But also in terms of what does space smell like, if we actually look at the Milky Way, so our galaxy, there is an area within the Milky Way, got this giant cloud of gas and dust. You've got this star-forming region. And they discover there it was packed full of this chemical known as ethyl formate, which is responsible for giving both raspberries and rum their flavour.
Oh,
so not only
lovely.
Do we have the teapot and sausages, we also have rum and raspberry as well.
And milk.
And yeah.
Milk for the tea, the Milky Way.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How exciting. we should acknowledge as well a quick shout out to Henrietta Swan Leavitt, who was known as the human computer, and at one point also worked at Harvard University's observatory many, many years before Shapley got there. She's the person who worked out a thing about the rate of pulses coming out of a star, which was then used by Hubble.
Oh, I see.
So she kind of like came up with the standard of this is how you can work out how far away a star is by measuring the luminosity of its pulses.
Yeah. Now you measure luminosity in crabs, I think, which is the Crab Nebula has a certain
glowing
has a certain luminosity. And it's like, is it brighter or less bright than the Crab Nebula? So if something's seven crabs, it's seven times brighter than the Crab Nebula.
Is this just a big like bar and grill restaurant out of space?
Yeah.
I don't mind it.
We should start a themed restaurant because the menu is looking really, really good. I guess, I mean, I don't know, but with the pulsars, with these stars that are pulsing, the Cepheid stars that we're able to measure distance with, I'm assuming that they're very, very unlikely to have life around them because the light they're emitting is so unreliable.
I've got a room at the moment with a bulb which is dodgy and you can't be in that room. Like it's on one of the old dimmer switches and we've put a new dimmer bulb in and it's just an absolute nightmare
it's
to
too
be
annoying.
In. I hate it.
Yeah.
So that makes
that's
sense.
Why.
That
that's
makes
why.
Sense to me.
It's just frustrating. But like, oh, that's really hot. Oh,
thank you,
cold.
Professor. What I really like about this thing about Shapley and Hubble is they suddenly increased the size of the universe that we knew, right? So we start with Ptolemy all the way back in ancient times, and he thought that the entire universe was 20,000 times the Earth's radius.
20,000. Okay.
And he worked that out by saying, okay, well, the Earth is here in the middle. Everything goes around us. And then there's Mercury and Venus and the Sun and Mars and Jupiter. And then there's something else and something else. And eventually you get to the stars. And he had this nice little sort of nesting tables where everything goes. And he worked that out. And then Newton comes along and says, okay, well, the stars don't seem to move much according to each other. So they don't have parallax, which is parallax is like if you... if you put your thumb in front of your face and then close one eye and close the other, it seems to move. Mm-hmm. But if you do it with something far away, it moves much less.
Mm.
So he worked out with the stars, they're not doing that, so they must be really far away. So that got the universe much, much bigger. And then a guy called Friedrich Bessel, he managed to work out the parallax, that there is slight parallax, and worked out that the universe is light years in size. And then we got this great debate. We worked out that there's more than one galaxy. And then they found background radiation, which meant that suddenly the universe is, we don't know how big it is, but the observable universe is as far as light could get to us from when the universe started.
Yes. Yeah. And I've
I just love how it kind
it's
of
really
expands.
Cool.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
How much further
presumably
can it go?
At some stage, it'll get bigger still. We just don't know how. It's
we don't know
bigger.
How. Yeah,
so cool. Well, this is the thing. You know, the new James Webb Space Telescope,
mm-hmm. yeah.
very,
yeah.
very, very big telescope.
Yeah,
launched into orbit for better views and things like that. And it has found six enormous ancient galaxies, which have been nicknamed the Universe Breakers.
Cool.
And I love this. And they shouldn't exist, right?
Oh, wow.
Wow.
There should only be, from the point of where they are, you know, we know how long the light has taken to travel to us. We know the rough age they are. They should not have had time to form because they date to 500 million years after the Big Bang.
Yeah.
There should only be tiny baby galaxies there, but they're very well developed.
And please tell me they look like a hash brown.
We need it on the menu.
Yeah.
Okay, it is time for fact number three, and that is Andy.
My fact is, the first ever geothermal power station powered 5 light bulbs.
Wow.
Amazing. Yep.
Some sources say 4. But I prefer yeah. to, I'm backing it. I think it
powers 5.
That's
the source I found, yeah. yeah. What?
The fifth one, it was light bulb, but it kept going on and off,
oh,
and it was
so
really annoying.
Yeah. I just have to turn it off after a while, work in the dark. This was in 1904, and we're in Tuscany.
Mm. Oh, lovely.
Lovely.
Oh,
love it when Andy paints a picture.
Absolutely.
Us,
yeah. Well, just hear those Tuscan local animals and flora and fauna.
Glass of Montepulciano. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Overlooking the Tower of Pisa.
Probably.
there Lots we of are. Tourists kind of pretending to hold it up.
And this is in an area called the Devil's Valley.
Ooh, which, so not the Tower of Pisa.
but I suppose it's appropriate that it was the Devil's Valley because we're going underground.
Oh, okay.
Into the warm.
Mm.
And this was where a guy called Prince Piero Ginori Conti lit up the first ever geothermal power station. So that is taking heat from underground, bringing it above ground. And there are various different ways you can harness the power. Mm-hmm. One of them is by directly using steam from underground to turn a turbine, which then spins up and generates electricity. Mm-hmm. There are lots of different methods of doing it, which I'm sure we'll get into. But this first little experiment did 4 or 5 light bulbs.
Oh,
it was just
cool.
So tiny.
Yeah.
But it's the cradle of geothermal, which is now being talked of as a big solution to lots of power shortages and a much, much cleaner way of powering the world than fossils. So
yeah.
There's a lot of renewed excitement about it.
And it's still
years.
Going, isn't it? Over 100 years later,
yep.
that exact spot, they mm-hmm. have a huge factory that is producing geothermal
yeah,
energy.
That Devil's Valley was the landscape that inspired Dante to make Hell in Divine Comedy.
Really?
So
wow.
when he writes about Hell, he's talking about that place.
Oh my goodness.
That's cool.
That isn't it? So not the picture I've seen painting for us at all.
Not from.
The opposite.
But yeah, really amazing, this guy. Was he a prince? I read he was Prince of Trevignano.
I think he was.
I couldn't get to the bottom of that either. It's sort of in some places it didn't mention it, and then other places suddenly Prince was attached to his name.
I think he was an aristocrat. He was, I'm afraid, second mention for the fascists in the show. He was mates with Mussolini.
Before or after it all went wrong?
He was friends when it was fashionable in Italy to be friends with Mussolini.
Okay.
I don't know what happened after the war.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I know what happened to Mussolini after the war.
No, I know.
But he was processing boric acid.
Yes.
Which sounds great. Boric acid.
From this particular area.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then he realized that he could make electricity from it and then started this geothermal company afterwards, didn't he?
Right.
I'm surprised this first happened in Tuscany, actually, because when I think of areas of geothermal activity, I immediately think of Iceland.
Yeah.
That's
Same,
kind of where I immediately go.
I think Italy's like a relatively big user of geothermal, despite like it's a tiny, tiny percentage of its power. It actually
they do
gets
have
from
a
it.
Few volcanoes there, don't they?
Oh,
I suppose.
Yeah, and basically that's the thing. Like, traditional geothermal relies on very specific conditions, which is it's tectonic things, lots of heat close to the surface, so you don't need to drill down for miles and miles and miles. So Iceland is brilliant for it because it's got exactly that. Kenya's very good for it. Iceland has installed underfloor heating outdoors.
Nice.
Outdoors,
so
like
under
pavement.
The roads. Yeah,
under the roads and
to
pavements.
Stop everything freezing over.
Yeah.
Well,
it got
clever.
So much warm water just close to the surface.
They just have, they're stunning.
That's very clever.
Yeah.
It's very clever.
They also have they grow more bananas in glasshouses in Iceland than they do anywhere else. Which yes. I think
really?
Kind of, I know they don't, so they aren't growing bananas commercially to sell because they don't actually have enough light to sort of for the turnover of bananas right. to be good enough. But they do have a lot of geothermally heated greenhouses. Right. So I think they can get enough heat going. I think the greenhouses have to be around 20 degrees permanently to get the bananas to grow, but then to also be using the geothermal energy to provide enough light that the bananas would also need. Yeah. It's just not commercially viable.
Yeah, yeah. So there are no like dark bananas that you can harvest
dark
in the like 8 month night or whatever.
They'll put a bit of light on, but I just don't think it's enough because they need so much light. Okay. But also tomatoes, various tropical fruits, algae. They're growing a lot of algae now using geothermal energy in Iceland.
Lovely.
Scrape it off to get your spirulina. Superfood.
In case you haven't picked it up already, I've got a reputation as the guy on the show who likes the boring stuff.
Which is slightly unfair because we all like the boring stuff.
But I really get excited, don't I? You know,
underfloor heating, invented by the Romans. Yeah. They had like a... your house or your villa would be maybe a few meters above the ground or a meter above the ground. And then people would set fires or boil water underneath and that would get you warm. But they put geothermal underfloor heating in Bath, in the city of Bath in the UK.
Mm.
Because down there, there's quite a lot of hot springs and stuff. They could actually have, there's a few villas in Bath where you would get the geothermal stuff.
It's amazing. Isn't it incredible that ancient Rome 2,000 years ago has underfloor heating and yet I don't? Do you know what I mean? Like, where's the
justice? You can afford it, Andy.
You can do it.
But it's such a pain in the bum to put in, you know?
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, why didn't they put it into my home whenever they were building it?
Yes.
Like, what's going on? Why is that?
Well, I think in the UK, we don't necessarily need it that much because we don't really get very hot or very cold days.
Mm. Yeah. I had it in my home in southeast London when I lived there. In our bathroom, but as the builder was putting the final tile down, he accidentally shredded one of the wires, and it was too expensive to do anything about it.
What do you mean?
So we have
shredded one.
He dropped it in one of those shredded wheat machines.
Basically, he said that he did something to one of the wires, and so it never worked.
You're joking.
No, but
so
it was there.
So it's all there.
It's all there. Just it never worked. So we technically had it, and we would always think about it.
That must have been a big consolation as you walked in onto the freezing cold floor in the winter morning.
Yeah.
We would tell people who visited, "Well, we got underfloor heating. It doesn't work, but we have it."
Did you still pay him?
Yeah. I mean, he was
he's done the work.
He's done the work.
Guy. He was a scary tradesman.
It's not his fault. Wires break.
Wow.
It does make me think, though. You know, like if someone in the past had made a slightly different decision, you know, would we be using geothermal energy more across the world? Because obviously there are some places where it makes sense to use it because it's easier to access. But I guess if you drill down deep enough, eventually you are going to tap into geothermal energy. So why is it we're not using it more? Because it does make an awful lot of sense.
It's just a pain to get down. It's just a pain to drill. It's initial pain. That's the problem.
It's very expensive to set up.
Exactly.
And if you do it the old way where you're looking for quite a hot magma field.
Yeah.
Because like you say, if you go deep enough anywhere, you're going to get hot.
Yeah.
But what they want to do is find somewhere that's not that deep.
Sure.
And dig down. And those places are really hard to find. It's not like, you know, it's obvious because these trees grow there, so it's going to be there.
Yeah.
Like, you basically have to keep digging until you find the right place.
Yeah.
Right.
And like there's recently, they've used AI in Nevada to find these zones where you can dig into. And they don't really know how the AI's found it. They basically put in all the information of all the different zones around the world where you can get this easy geothermal energy. And the AI models have just found the signal out of the noise. It's just like they've worked out where it is, even though they're not quite sure how they did it. But it does work.
Wow.
It's one good use of it.
Yeah.
And now they got enough energy from the geothermal to pay for one AI question on ChatGPT.
As we said, it's tricky to do everywhere because digging down is expensive and it's more economical if there's lots of heat close to the surface, which is only true in a few places. So there are lots of things being tried to get around this now. Mm. One of them is just most heat you need, unless it's like industrial heat for a factory, is actually pretty low. And so that's these boreholes, the ground source heat pump thing. Like China's going gangbusters on that. Mm. And there are other kind of wacky versions of geothermal. There's enhanced, there's advanced, and there's supercritical hot rock.
Okay. I'm going to choose the last one.
That's a cool kind of rock music, isn't it?
That should be a genre.
Yeah, shouldn't it?
So here's an idea that's being experimented with. You drill a couple of holes. You drill down a mile or two, right? Mm-hmm. Two separate shafts.
Right.
You then drill sideways between the shafts, okay? Mm-hmm. So you've joined them up. You've made a sort of...
Like a U-shape.
Like a U-shape. Yeah, exactly. Then you pump water down hole one, mm-hmm. and you're pumping it towards hole number two,
yeah. mm-hmm.
and you're sort of cracking the rocks along the way, yeah. and the water is taking all the heat out of these rather hot rocks,
yeah.
and then the water is pumped out of a second well, and it's at 200 degrees Celsius. Ah. How can it be at 200 degrees? Water boils at 100 degrees.
It must be high pressure.
It's high pressure. It's really high Boyle's pressure. Law. And you get this thing, you get... superheated, sort of supercritical steam, which can drive a turbine extremely well, or you just use that heat to actually heat up other water, which then drives a turbine. Like, there are different methods of doing it. It's very, very cool.
It's actually quite similar to fracking, isn't it?
It is. It's basically fracking.
So yeah, they use the technology that fracking did to get oil out, but instead of doing that, they put water in and heated it up.
Exactly.
Which is another reason why a lot of people aren't that happy about it, because fracking can cause earthquakes.
Yes.
Right.
So, yeah.
But is it a better way to use fracking technology, potentially?
Undoubtedly, yeah. Because you're getting...
That's a lot greener, yeah.
It's much greener.
Yeah.
Nice. Another way you can do it is, instead of using water, you might be able to use hydrogen. And this is something called the Johnson Thermoelectric Energy Converter. And the best thing about it is it's solid state. So you put it into the water and it's just one object. You put it in and then it gets electricity out of it. And it was invented by a guy called Lonnie Johnson, who also invented the Super Soaker. Isn't that amazing?
I thought I recognised that name from somewhere.
Yeah. Wow. It's very, very... At the moment, they're not using it. But it might be used in the future. And it's this guy is wants to use it in LA, where they have a lot of like old oil wells. So they've already got the holes down there. So you can just put stuff down there. At the moment, the temperature in those oil wells is too low and you can't really get much geothermal out. But because this is so efficient, you might be able to use it.
That's interesting.
Wow. Mm. Yeah. But anyway, he invented the Super Soaker. So
that's, I mean, love that. The difference in those two inventions is like the equivalent of like Einstein doing E equals MC squared. It's like, what's he going to do for his next equation? Viva 6 afraid of 7. 7, 8, 9? Like, that's that similarity. That's amazing. Yeah.
Okay, it's time for our final fact of the show, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that in Peru, you can be sued by a bee.
And he's got 20 million witnesses.
Any type of bee?
Not really, no. It has to be a stingless bee.
Okay.
It has to be in one of two parts of Peru, the town of Sapito or the Loreto department, but they're both in the Amazon. And it turns out that these areas have stingless bees that are very, very important to indigenous communities. And they've been hurt by, you know, pollution, climate change, habitat loss, all that kind of stuff. And so these two areas of Peru have given them rights. And while the bee can't fill out the paperwork, a human can act on their behalf. And so if, like, let's say a tree felling company comes into the Amazon, cuts down a load of habitat of these bees, then environmental company can go over and sue them on behalf of the bees.
Can I sue a bee?
If they have rights
in just those two places.
Yeah.
Why they can't sting you. They're stingless. So I think the best they could do is give you a little nibble.
They can bite. Those bees can bite.
Why are you going to sue them?
I'm just trying to work out what this new right has given them. Is there a flip side consequence?
For money. Dan's doing it for the payout. Sorry to cut through, Dan. But
classic hive chaser.
But also, can you sue a single bee, or does it have to be the colony? I wonder if you can take up a personal grievance with a bee.
I think Rowan Atkinson's just made a very successful series about this, hasn't he? Man versus Bee. They don't cover series two of Man versus Bee, which is just the legal battle afterwards.
Set in the Amazon.
Yeah. They do sound cool, these bees.
They're amazing.
There's one big lie about stingless bees.
Yeah.
They do have stings.
What?
Yes, they do.
I didn't know this. I mean, I didn't know the stingless bee was a thing until this week, so... But
imagine
imagine the roller coaster that you've been on. Oh my God, there's a thing called a stingless bee. Oh my God, they have stings.
I know. I did. I thought, oh, they're harmless, but they're not. So the stings are called degenerate stings because they're so small and ineffective that they don't count.
Aww.
I know. But they do, as you said, Dan, they bite like the devil. They'll mm-hmm. do suicidal biting, which yes. is a biological term.
What?
Which is where they bite and bite and bite and bite and bite
yeah.
you.
Just
and,
you.
Yeah, just
you. Going after the bees. They're coming for you, Dan.
And basically, they will keep biting. And if you try and pull them away,
yeah.
They will suffer fatal damage to their body rather than stop biting.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, rip someone... their heads off.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's yeah. it. Yeah. So they will just clamp down their jaws yeah. with so much vigor that they just will not let go.
Like a right. dangerous dog.
Like a dangerous dog.
You know, they always say that the yeah. dogs will clamp onto you and they right. won't let go unless you put your finger up the bum. Yeah.
That is true.
And I don't suppose you could do that with a bee.
No.
Well, there's a useless sting in the world. But those are suicidal tendencies. We see that in bees with stings as well.
Oh,
it's
really?
Just okay. when you... So the bees that we have in here in Europe, in UK, Apis mellifera, they will sting you. But sadly, when they sting you, their sting will... The barbs will get stuck in your skin and this essentially rips out their abdomen.
Right.
So I guess we're seeing the same behaviour in the stingless bee. It's just that they are physically choosing to not let go when they could.
Yeah.
So that instinct to protect is so intense that yeah.
You're a beekeeper, aren't you?
I am. Yeah.
How many have you got?
70,000.
It's always.
How many?
And their names are
70,000.
Yeah, I'd say rough, yeah.
Wow. How many hives is that?
Two. So less at the moment because it's January. So the hives they significantly decrease in numbers over the winter. But yeah, I would say in the height of the summer, yeah, around 70,000, 80,000.
So cool.
That is
gals.
Amazing.
Have you been stung?
Many times.
Have you?
Many Ooh. Times. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So certainly do have stings.
Where's the most painful spot?
Oh, painful. The most annoying was on my forehead. I sort of looked like a Star Trek character for quite some time. That took a long time to go down. I do have to be careful, though, because every time I get stung, I think I'm reacting a little bit more single time. So I do need to be cautious.
Yeah, that's very cool. And do you use the honey for yourself? Do you sell it in local shops and farm
No.
markets?
I would say only just about get enough honey to sort of maybe get me through a few months.
Okay.
For me, extracting the honey is it's something that has been developed over hundreds and thousands of years. The bees, they will store their honey in honeycomb. We encourage them to store that honey in frames that can be easily removed from the hive. But stingless bees, you can also harvest their honey. It's just much harder because stingless bees don't make honeycomb. Instead, they store their honey in little sort of tiny honey pots that are about the size of grapes. And they're all...
Oh,
sort of, yeah, so they're
adorable.
All sort of...
Like a little Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah, they're all like clustered together.
What's it made of? What's the pot?
So it's similar to a sort of a sticky substance that European bees make, which is called propolis, which is a combination of wax, but you also get various tree saps and resins as well in the mix. So it kind of makes a bee polyfiller material. But if you want to harvest the honey, to not destroy the hive, you would have to go in with a pipette or a syringe and individually sort of go into these little honey pots and take the honey out.
That's so amazing.
You can harvest it. It's a lot more time consuming.
And I think that people buy it and it's very, very expensive, right?
I would assume so because it's so labor intensive.
Stingless bee honey.
Yeah, and it's been used like for medicine by, you know, indigenous people for hundreds of years, I'm sure.
Yeah.
They use it for, what do they use it for? They use it for if you've got like a cough, if you've got some phlegm on your chest, they use it for that, like we would with honey, I suppose. But also for infertility, rheumatism, anemia, and arthritis. And they make alcohol out of it.
Right.
And if you want to go and harvest it, according to locals, if on a full moon night you grab a queen bee, squeeze her abdomen and smear the liquid that comes out of her onto your eyelids, then you'll be able to temporarily see every bee's nest in the forest in the dark.
Great.
That's okay. Night vision.
If you're ever in the Amazon.
That's pretty cool.
I'm not sure it's entirely true.
I'm sure. It's, I love it though.
Sounds legit.
And your bees are all gals, did you say?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah.
Because you've got a queen and then...
All the girls.
Are they the drones? Workers?
Worker bees. Workers. Yeah, so all the worker bees are female, and then she'll keep a couple of lads around, but really their only purpose is to go off and mate with a queen from another hive. So to be honest, the boys don't do anything. They are really very useless.
Have you met the boys?
You can see them. They're sort of, they're much larger. They're quite clumsy. Yeah. They kind of just dodder about, not really doing anything, getting in the way.
The bees, Maddie, the bees. Come on.
So yeah, there aren't many, and actually the girls will kick them out come September.
Is that so?
Yeah, get them out. They're not useful anymore.
Where do they go?
They die. They're on the floor.
Oh dear.
Yeah, yeah. So it's the cleaner bees, or the undertaker bees. In fact, they get called. It's their responsibility to take out the dead. So quite often, sort of as you're approaching the winter months, you'll just see just a graveyard of bees in front of the hives where they've all been taken out, just to make sure things are clean for the winter.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Wow.
I've got a case of a goat suing a pig here.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Go on.
2014. The pig is Peppa Pig.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And the goat is Gabriella Capra.
Oh, yes.
Oh, Capra.
Whose name in Italian means Gabriella Goat. And it's a character in Peppa Pig called Gabriella Goat. And in the Italian Peppa Pig, she's Gabriella Capra. Uh-huh. And she said she needed €100,000 to compensate her because she was annoyed.
Because they used her name.
Because they used her name.
Oh, right.
It doesn't look like she got it. The case goes very, very quiet after a blizzard of publicity.
Yeah.
But in 2022, the owners of Peppa Pig themselves sued a Vietnamese firm, which had made a very, very, very similar looking and feeling franchise called Wolfu. So that's three little pigs suing a wolf.
Oh.
That's good, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a family of four in Peppa Pig, but yeah, that's...
Yeah, I don't think the younger kid Someone's was part of the lawsuit. I was trying to... Sorry,
but Peppa is?
Oh my God, you try and do something. You try and do something.
I started looking at just generally the rights of other animals. And I couldn't find many examples where animals had been given the equivalent to human rights. There certainly are some that exist, but I was able to find quite a few examples where animals are being protected from humans doing stupid things. In Alaska, to protect these hibernating bears, the US have enacted a law saying it's completely illegal to wake a bear for a photo, but it is okay to hunt them.
Okay.
That feels like it's protecting the photographer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course.
You can't be allowed to shoot a hibernating bear.
You would hope so. You would hope that a hibernating bear is protected regardless.
If you're out there right now listening as you take aim,
don't do
from
it.
From 2 feet away, grow up, mate.
But they said it's okay to take a photo, a selfie with a completely awake bear.
Yeah, fine.
All right. Actively encouraged.
Yeah. Well, but also in Alaska, not just thinking about the bears here, we're also protecting moose. You are not allowed to push one out of an aeroplane. Just in case you ever considered it. Yeah, yeah. Not allowed.
Fun police are at it again. Eh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things we've said over the course of this podcast, we can all be found online. I'm on @Schreiberland on Instagram. James?
My Instagram is no such thing as James Harkin.
Andy?
I'm at Andrew Hunter M.
Yep, and Maddie?
You can find me at Maddie Mote on Instagram and YouTube.
Yes, get to the YouTube channel. It's incredible. If you've got kids in your life, honestly, it's the place to go. So yeah, you can get to us, by the way, as a group on podcast@qi.com. That's our email. All those emails go to Andy. We read out the best on Drop Us a Line, aka Jewel. And that is part of Club Fish, which is our Patreon secret members club. So if you want to check that out, go to patreon.com/nosuchthingasafish. Lots of fun things going on there. Otherwise, just come back next week because we're going to have another episode for you. Thank you as ever to the Fish team, Liying Lee and Ethan Ruparelia, as well as the larger Fishbusters in the office here. And we'll see you again next week. Goodbye.